I believe you got one of my children in your jail here.
How dare you walk into my office and pull a gun on me?
Get your finger out of the end of my gun.
How dare you pull a gun on me?
I said take your finger out of the end of my gun.
Well, until I do, you better take your finger off that trigger and let the hammer down real slow.
That gun had gone off and it blown right up in the face.
Well, now, it wouldn't have done my finger a hell of a lot of good either, would it?
This is the emergency podcast system. This is not a test. Movies are bombing all over the country. They are posing as movies you already know. They may already be in your theaters, your neighbor's home, or even your own. Do not panic. Specialists have been dispatched. They will help you identify these pretenders and defend you against this invasion of the remake. Please stand by for further instructions.
Welcome to the Invasion of the Remake podcast. I'm your sheriff, Jason Bishop. And with me in the office is my deputy, Sam Stepanenko.
Wait. Okay, go ahead.
And the mayor's clumsy-ass daughter, Trish Cocklett.
Excuse me? How dare you call me clumsy? I climbed up that tree and I was fine. And I got down from the tree and I was fine. Can a clumsy gal do that?
Fine. Be that way. And we've run that scalawag, Jeff Omega, out of town, because he doesn't want to do support your local sheriff this week. Or maybe he does. I don't know. He's busy.
Yes.
Very
the
busy.
Only thing Jeff has stolen is hearts.
Because he quite literally has run out of town. He's on his way to the other side of the country.
Yes.
Soon.
Yeah.
Yes.
Local scalawag from Calgary, Alberta, moving to New Brunswick.
Yeah.
We're too cowboy here for him, apparently.
Apparently.
It's like reverse pioneering. You know, they started off in the east and like went west, and now he's west going east.
So yeah, he's going to be absent from the show for a little while, but that's okay. We'll hopefully get him down the road once he's all settled in after his moves. June, July, maybe. I'm not going to set a date. You get somewhere and you realize it's going to take a lot longer to get settled than you think. So we'll hopefully Jeff will return later this year. But this week we're going to return to our fan challenges, finally getting back to it, and this is a long-awaited one by Keith, a.k.a. Kit Reader, over on Twitter, and he asked us to remake Support Your Local Sheriff from 1969. And me being a fan of Westerns, of course I said yes.
Yes, I will say thank you to Keith, because this is going to be a fun episode. I really enjoyed this movie.
Me too. I can't believe I hadn't heard of it. It was a very enjoyable movie.
That's interesting because I had seen this before. I'd kind of forgotten about it. But as soon as I started watching it, I'm like, oh, I remember this movie now. I'd seen it when I was a kid and probably more than once because I really like James Gardner. This movie, you could kind of see like there was aspects of his old Maverick role in there, as well as you could see a little bit of Jim Rockford coming through in this part as well. It was a lot of fun. I really liked kind of rediscovering it, and I've forgotten how much I enjoyed this movie. Was this first time for both you guys?
It might have been. I remembered parts of it, but not enough of it to say, yeah, I remember seeing the whole thing, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I totally get it. You might have seen it. It might have been on TV, maybe, and you've seen part of it, because it's
possibly
a very family-friendly movie you could put on television.
It generally is, yeah, and certainly, I mean, it came out the year I was born, so, I mean, I'm sure it showed up on TV at some point, but yeah, my memory from, well, yesterday is vague at best, so, yeah, I can't say for certain that I've seen it before, but it doesn't matter, because I really enjoyed watching it this time.
That also makes it kind of a challenge, because it's a lot actually harder to remake a movie when you really already like it.
Yes.
So we always try to remake things with a nugget of a good idea that may not have been that great to begin with. At least that's usually our mission statement. But with fan challenges, we don't always know. And sometimes we're given quite a good movie to remake, which makes it even a bigger challenge. This one's even more so because now we're asked to be remaking a police-friendly film in an era where the populace has some questions regarding our protectors. That could make it a little tougher, but we'll find some angles to satisfy everybody, I think.
I think this movie did a good job of showing responsible policing, actually.
Yeah.
If you really think about it, I mean, when somebody raises an objection about, are you going to accuse, what does she say? Are you going to kill another person or some more people? And he decides to find a different way to address the problem and starts throwing rocks at them.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Right. So, I mean, that's responsible policing right there.
Yeah. Yeah. He's, for the most part, James Gardner was trying not to hurt anybody through most of the film. And there's a kind of a cheeky confidence to him. And yes, he's a crack shot, and yes, he does kill some people, but they were trying to kill him first.
Absolutely.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
If you're a gunfighter, that's what you come in on. Yeah. Like, I mean, that's the whole point. If you bring a gun, he's going to shoot you. But if you don't have a gun, he's not going to.
Yeah.
But it's also part of the sort of capitalism of the place. Like, that's where kind of a lot of the corruption is, because they wanted a sheriff, but they didn't want the sheriff to do the sheriff's job. Because they're like, oh, we're still making a lot of money and we're pretty happy with that. So the lawlessness is fine. So I don't quite understand. Like, at certain points, they're like, yeah, we kind of need somebody to take care of the Dambies. But then when it comes time to take care of the Dambies, they're like, oh, please don't take care of the Dambies. Like, what are you doing?
Well, I think they just wanted to have people settle down within the town so much, but they wanted to keep the Dambies happy because they were between the town and where they were delivering their gold for processing. And if the Dambies weren't getting their cut, they would just take it. They would do a robbery. So they wanted to keep the Dambies happy so everybody could get paid. Well, it was basically a racket.
But they also were very upset about giving the Dambies their cut.
There was more to it because they were afraid that the sheriff wouldn't successfully take it down the Dambies, and they were afraid of the repercussions as well.
Yeah, because I mean, if he didn't, it would be like the Dambies like, fine, now it's 40%, which is what I would have made as an argument against the guys not helping out the sheriff. It'd be like, well, if he doesn't succeed, the Dambies are going for 40%. So good luck, everybody. You screwed up by being cowards.
Or worse, 100%, right?
Right.
Because if they don't get paid, they're just going to take it all for themselves.
Exactly. So by being cowards, they really were screwing themselves, but they didn't realize that.
Well, and I think part of it, too, is not realizing how incompetent the Dambies really were.
Yeah. They got lucky a lot, and then the reputation became more than what they were.
Well, they were overconfidence was built up because they had a town that wasn't resisting them. So they didn't really have to try too hard. And when somebody comes in and resists to the status quo, they're not sure what to do about it, clearly.
Yeah. They spend a ton of money getting gunfighters to come in.
Yeah. Just the setup of the town. Like, the town was built so quickly when they found this gold at the beginning of the movie. And this is a Western comedy, by the way.
Yeah.
There's a funeral at the beginning of this movie, and there's gold found in the grave, spotted in the grave during the funeral. Now, if that sounds familiar, the same thing happened in Paint Your Wagon from 1969, which we covered a long time ago as another fan challenge. And there was even a bit of a lawsuit on the part of Warner Brothers because of it. It was just, they were in sync when they were thinking about this. I mean, they came out the same year, so it was unlikely there was any theft happening in this movie because of it. Now, it didn't keep this movie from stealing and spoofing other Western movies. So, but that one in particular wasn't on purpose.
It's just a funny thought. Like, I mean, you're having this very morose event, and then somebody's like, oh, look, there's gold. And then all hell breaks loose. It's pretty funny.
The next time you see the town, it's a full grown town. It was a tent town before that. Just a few people seeing if this is a place to settle. Then they find the gold, and then next thing you know, like, there's full-on houses and saloons, and it's a full-on Western town.
I love the note about inflation. That really was a great idea, because that was the sort of the realism of it, where it's like, we will charge as much as we can get away with in this town.
Yeah, you've got everybody staking their claims for gold and stuff. So everybody's making some good coin. So just living in this town, because it's so crowded with prospectors, like food costs will literally go up while you're eating your meal. Yep. And of course, the stay and stuff. And it doesn't take long for James Cardner's character, well-named character, Jason, to... to come into town and realize I'm going to be broke before the end of the day.
Yeah. Now, do they ever actually say his name in the movie? Because I was listening and I'm like, they call him Sheriff.
Yeah.
Once he's a sheriff, but I don't think they ever actually say his name.
You are wrong. His full name is Jason McCullough.
But does he say it?
Yes. Well, yeah, he introduces himself. I caught it. I wrote it down.
Okay. Apparently that was one of those rare moments where I did look away. Cause yeah, I'm like, I know his name's Jason, but I didn't hear him say it. But again, like I said,
Yeah, it was shortly after the saloon, I think, maybe when he was introducing himself to the mayor.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. That's right. Yeah. Now I do remember. Make yourself look stupid, Sam.
No. It's easy to miss because I sort of throughout the movie, it disappeared from my brain because throughout the movie, it just got replaced with the word sheriff. Yeah. So I was like, I couldn't gain it.
Yeah. And I think that was the only time they really mentioned his name. I don't remember him. He might have introduced himself to a couple more characters, but I think that's the only time we hear his full name.
One name you cannot forget is Prudy. Yeah, that said a lot.
That's a very Western town with the name of Prudy. There are some names that just have drifted away with time, Prudy being one of them.
Yep.
And Ollie.
Yeah.
And Ollie. I like Ollie, but Ollie, I think, is making a comeback.
Hey, our mouse's name is Ollie.
Nice.
Yeah. He's Ollie the Mouse.
And he's going to be mayor of Samtown.
Oh, yeah. He already owns the whole town.
Oh, so it's Ratatouille time.
Yeah.
But like with a mayor instead of a chef.
Yeah, that's him. But yeah, one of the things that, because Prudy's the one who spots the gold.
Yes.
And so it's revealed throughout the movie that she actually is the richest person in town because she has the biggest claim, I guess, or I'm not sure if she gets a percentage.
Yeah, she owns like one of the big mining companies and is the sole owner of one of the biggest mining companies in the town. Like there's others, the town founders have split up the major claims amongst themselves, but she's one of the biggest owners and you don't realize it right away, but that's actually one of the hooks along the way is, oh yeah, she is one of the biggest stakeholders in this town. And there's a pretty risque joke made at that expense as well.
What are you?
You was on fire, Prudy! Prudy, you was on fire!
Fire? Happened to me, and somebody better do something about it soon.
Well, that's quite a daughter you got yourself there, Mr. Mayor.
I think she's crazy.
Now, why would you think a thing like that? I know why I'd think it.
She's had some terrible shocks this year. She got wealthy almost overnight. I think maybe it unhinged her a little bit. Then she was always kind of big for her age, and puberty hit her hard. That'll do it, you know.
I didn't know that.
Well, it will. As a disinterested stranger, how does she hit you?
Well, she...
I mean, you are disinterested, ain't you?
Oh, I think you could safely say that, yes.
She's a rich little old gal in her own name, Sheriff. Sole owner of the Millard Frymore Memorial Mining Company.
You meaning whoever marries her gets the mine?
Shaft and all.
Yeah, well, that won't hurt her in certain circles, will it?
Well, to be fair, that's kind of how it worked. When you got married, a man just took... The ownership was automatically transferred to him.
Yeah. And that might have been one of the reasons that she was kind of reluctant or not interested in anybody in town because they were all ragamuffins.
Absolutely.
And scoundrels, and she didn't want to give up her.
Well, they'd run her company into the ground.
Yeah.
Like that's the whole thing. Like this was the stupid part. Like once you got married, you lost everything. So the point of getting married just seemed stupid at that point in time. I never understood it.
And she was also really crazy. So I don't think a whole lot of people were interested.
Well, I kept looking at like she was really crazy, but I mean, there's so many things that would probably make her crazy where people just keep hitting on her and trying to get her money. I mean, that really brings up a sense of paranoia.
Well, her dad actually kind of brings that up. Her dad actually brings that up a little bit.
Yeah.
Is things kind of changed for her when she found the gold and her whole life kind of changed because of that. And it doesn't outright say about the paranoia and stuff, but you can certainly make allusions to that and to become that rich that quickly. And then he blames puberty as well, but
yeah, that's dumb. And then there's the whole point too, where it's she is basically one of the wealthiest people in town, but as a woman, because of the whole thing with like voting and everything else, she doesn't really have a say in a bunch of crap, even though she probably should.
Yeah, which sure makes her quite angry.
Yeah, it pissed me off. That's part of it. Like,
yeah, she's angry and paranoid. And it does show in the way the performance is done. So,
yeah, she did a great job with that. And part of it too is when you look at the men in that town, they're all dirty, unreliable, drifter type guys. And then Jason rolls around. He's clean cut. He's clean shaven. He's handsome. He's well dressed.
Thank you.
Well spoken.
Thank you, ladies.
Yep. He takes care of things. And he's looking to like make enough to get to Australia. He's not looking for a giant fortune. He's just trying to get his way to Australia.
Yeah. And that's his one failing, as far as she's concerned, is the fact that he's not planning on sticking around and never was. Because everything else about him is the antithesis to all the other men in the town.
Yep.
Wait. He's horseback on his way to Australia. We're just skipping over this weird little thing.
I'm on my way
to Australia. And it comes up over and over again. And you're left going, but why?
Oh, because he says it. He doesn't have the money. He needs to prospect so he can pay for his way to Australia.
No, but we never find out why he wants to go to Australia.
Oh, yeah, you don't. But I mean,
yes, you do.
He does say it's an amazing place, lots of stuff, and it's a new place. That's all he wants.
Yeah, no, he read about it and he just wanted to go.
Yeah.
He explains that to the deputy character whose name I just forgot.
Oh, Jake. Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, he explains it to Jake. He says, yeah, no, when I was growing up, I read books about Australia and it sounds fascinating. And they have animals that jump and will box you and carry stuff in their tummies. And like he's just fascinated by the lore of Australia and he just wants to go.
Yeah, I was the same way. I was a very similar Jason growing up, wanting to go to Australia. And then I got older and learned about all the things that can kill you in Australia.
Yeah.
and how fucking hot it is in Australia. Like,
at that point,
it's okay. I can live
at that point. At that point, they probably didn't care. And here's the thing. This is the Old West. There's a lot more stuff that could kill you. So, I mean,
yeah, I guess the risk was 50-50. It was just as even odds at that point.
Exactly. He's kind of like, well, I mean, I could die here from a rattlesnake bite or can die from a snake bite over there.
Or a metal mosquito just zipping on by.
Right.
Those could be bullets.
Yep.
All right. Let's get to the trailer for Support Your Local Sheriff from 1969. And we'll be right back with some stats.
The people of the town of Elephant's Breath, Montana, did not support their local sheriff. And this is what happened. The residents of Sagging Bag, Arizona, did not support their local sheriff. And whammo. And now the town of Callander, Colorado, is facing the same fate. Because Callander is a wide-open town where men fight in the streets and women litter. And there's a terrible traffic problem, a gun control problem, and no morals at all.
You want to grab something?
Everything looks too slippery.
What does that mean?
That's not the question. The question is, will Callander support their local sheriff? His name is Jason McCullough, and he alone holds the answers to Callander's problems. The rock. Or the rope. Or, when everything else fails, the finger.
He stuck his finger in the end of your what?
All Jason needs is the town's support and the love of a good woman.
He's had some terrible shocks this year. She got wealthy almost overnight. I think maybe it unhinged her a little bit. Then she was always kind of big for her age, and puberty hit her hard. That'll do it, you know.
Never has the West been wilder.
Hold it! Hold it! Just put it out there! Just hold it!
Okay, go ahead!
James Garner. Joan Hackett. Walter Brennan. Harry Morgan. Jack Eaton. Your local sheriff.
That was the trailer for Support Your Local Sheriff from 1969, written by William Bowers, who wrote My Man Godfrey and My Favorite Spy, directed by Burt Kennedy, who directed things like, his first film, The Canadians. Thank you.
All right.
Yeah, I know, right? You're already good on my list. Suburban Commando. Well, maybe not. And this one's fantastic. I might just have to see it. Dirty Dingus McGee.
I love it.
You know what? I don't want to. I just want to figure out what it is from that title. I want to create a movie.
I think there are certain parts of that title that have different meanings now.
They do. I mean, I'm not going to lie when I think part of it might be a porn parody, but I'm just saying.
This movie stars James Garner as Jason, the sheriff, and of course, most famous for Maverick and the Rockford Files. And I'm so glad we finally get to talk about him now. And I do have another one in my brain that I do want to remake down the road. This will be the first time we talk about James Garner, but certainly not the last. Mm-hmm. Joan Hackett was Prudy. She was in Dead of Night. Walter Brennan was Pa Danby. And this is kind of his spoof of a similar character he played in My Sweet Clementine. He was in How the West Would Won as well. And Rio Bravo. He was in some really great westerns of the day. Harry nice. Morgan. Most people here should remember Harry Morgan from MASH, of course, and Dragnet. And he plays Ollie Perkins. We have talked about Harry Morgan before because he was in episode 47.
He's in High Noon.
That's right. And once again, we talked about him in episode 152.
It's hard to imagine how far back his career went because he was in The Big Clock as well. So his career went way back to the late 40s, early 50s.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's been around a long time. There's only one surviving actor actually left in this, as Bruce Dern is still around with us, but everybody else has passed on.
He's still working.
I know. It's crazy. Doing Tarantino movies.
Yeah.
Jack Ellum was Jake, and we've talked about him before. Again, episode 47, High Noon, and episode 272, fairly recently.
Cannonball Run.
That's right, Cannonball Run. And Henry Jones plays Henry Jackson, and we've may have mentioned him a couple of times. First time might have been in episode 116.
I missed that one, Jay.
310 to Yuma.
Ah.
And then again in episode 148.
I didn't miss this one. It was Arachnophobia, yes. All about the spiders.
That's right.
Ooh.
One of Trish's favorites.
That was my only problem with Australia. The snakes I'm fine with, but the spiders, we had a problem.
Bruce Dern was Joe Danby, and he's a fairly important character in this one. We talked about Bruce Dern first time was actually in episode 127.
Silent Running, such a great movie.
Yeah, and then again in 163.
A less great movie, The Haunting.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be honest, I don't even remember him in that one.
He played the caretaker. Yeah.
He only had
maybe 2 minutes of screen time.
Yeah, I do remember
where they're
that.
They're like, we're leaving and we're not coming back till the morning.
Yeah, that's right. Willis Bouchy was Thomas Devery, and he was in the Ant film Them, as well as episode 93.
I love it when we throw back to Zero Hour and Airplane.
Yeah, he was in the Zero Hour. Gene Evans plays Tom Danby, and we probably talked about in episode 97.
Walking Tall.
That's right. Walter Burke was Fred Johnson, and he was in All the King's Men and M, Dick Peabody was Luke Danby, and he was probably most well known for being in a TV show called Combat. There are a lot of movies here and TV shows with exclamation points. I don't know why.
I was thinking the same thing.
How important is an exclamation point in a title?
I apparently think they just wanted... Well, it was to illustrate the importance. They're kind of just like, hey, guys, notice what we've got here. There's an exclamation point.
Yes, it's not just, you can't just say 0 hour. It's 0 hour. Them. Combat. Kathleen Freeman was Mrs. Danvers. Episode 38, we probably talked about her the first time, which was?
Point blank.
And then again in episode 101.
The fly.
Thank you for adding the sound effect. Dick Haynes was the bartender, and I just want to see it because he was in a movie called The Phantom Planet, and sounds like a wonderful 50s B-movie throwback.
Yeah.
At least by that title. I don't know. Could be a drama as far as I know. Mm. And there's a character, well, there's an actor who sounds like a character named Chubby Johnson. Let that one sink in for a second. Sure it's not a porn parody? No, I'm pretty sure. he played a character named Brady, but his scenes were all deleted, maybe because his name was Chubby Johnson, and then they realized what the joke was. But he was also in episode 47, High Noon, where it's highly likely I made the same jokes.
Probably. Ah, Chubby. What are we going to do with you?
Chubby Johnson. That's one hell of a stage name.
I'm glad it's a stage name. Could you imagine being a child with that name?
No, I'm assuming it's a stage name.
No, that's what I'm saying. I'm glad it's a stage name. I mean, at least at this point, like, you kind of realize what you're cashing in on. It's like, you're looking for a chubby character? Why not cast Chubby Johnson?
The irony is, I saw pictures of him. He's not that chubby.
I just maybe thought it was like a dick joke. It was funny that you didn't go there at all.
No.
Oh, I knew where you were going. I knew what you were thinking. But yeah, when he came up with his stage name, I don't think it might have been
by the 60s. Yeah, I'm thinking Johnson was already being used as a euphemism. So a Chubby Johnson.
That's a porn name.
That is a porn
Sorry,
name.
Chubby Johnson.
Welcome to my sense of humor, Trish.
Oh no, I get it. I just don't know. I guess I'm just worried about all this quarantine weight I've been gaining, so I automatically went to the other reason of chubby.
Well, we all feel that way, so I understand. Okay, so support your local sheriff. Basically, this town is needing a lawman, and this guy needs food and shelter and I know a living wage if he's going to make a stake in this town for a little while on his way to Australia. And sees the wanted poster, signs up. Initially, there's a little resistance until he shoots a bullet through a washer, which is
twice.
Yeah, the first time it's like nobody sees the bullet go through, so they're like, "Well, how do we know you shot something through a hole? It might have just been around it." So he puts a little tape on it and shoots through again. And of course, he's a dead shot. But that is a scene pulled from Winchester 73, where a similar gag was done with an Indian artifact with a hole in the center. And then the character puts a postage stamp over the hole to prove his marksmanship.
Well, and you can see why they'd ask.
And after that, there's a lot more respect in their dealing with him. There's another really cool scene, too. Like, it's funny, the marksmanship is proven differently in here. We've seen lots of Westerns where somebody says it's a crack shot and he's really good at killing people. In here, they prove it by, shooting through a washer that he throws up in the air, or pounding a nail into a post by shooting the nail, which I thought was really cool.
I really liked that.
Yep. I thought that was good. And then when he's trying to break up that thing and Jake tries to pull the gun, he just shoots it out of his hand because he's like, I don't need to shoot anybody. I'm just trying to make my point.
Yeah, exactly. And I love how he does that. Like, he has the skills, but he's not going to necessarily use them to lethal effect. He certainly can. He'll outdraw anybody there and outshoot anybody there. So he's not too worried about it, which I think adds to his cockiness a bit.
Well, there's at one point where Jake kind of asks him, he's like, if you're so good, why don't you have a reputation? And James Garner's like, what do we need one of those for? He's kind of like, I know I can shoot. I know I can do it well. Like, I don't need other people's approval.
Yeah. He just doesn't care.
Yeah, he's not walking around looking for fights, but he knows how to handle himself if there is one.
Yes.
And when he first gets into town, he hunkers into a bar and watches Bruce Dern shoot somebody basically in cold blood on a card game he was most likely losing. And he's trying to convince everybody in the tavern, no, you saw it. He shot first. And he was using this little trick to make the guy draw first, where he's actually pulling his gun from his holster with this little shoulder move. And James Gardner picks up on it right away. So one of his first acts as being appointed a sheriff is, go tell him I'm going to arrest him. And
yeah.
He goes get settled in the town first before he goes and gets him.
Oh, yeah. He's kind of like, he's not going anywhere. I'll just go pick him up when I pick him up.
Yeah.
And they have a jail. It's supposed to be inescapable, but the bars haven't arrived yet.
Yeah, state of the art. And it's well-built brick, but they haven't installed the bars. And his solution to that is fantastic. There was something that really kind of ticked me off a little bit, though. It's like, but you do have, like, manacle loops in the jail that are affixed to the wall. So you could have kept them secure at any point. At one point, they even say, oh, I chained him to the broiler.
Yeah.
But you actually had something to chain him to in the cell, and you never used it.
I think it was a power move about respect.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, I can't control this town unless people respect me. And I can get, like, if I know they won't leave when I tell them not to leave, they'll respect me.
Yeah.
And I've got their respect, so I don't have to do as much work.
He does it in such a clever way. He finds a little bit of chalk, draws this line where the bars would be, and then there's a little bit of paint in a bucket that just happens to be there, and it's red paint, and he kind of splatters it as if this was the last guy who crossed the line.
Yep.
And it was brilliant. It was a brilliant move, and if Bruce Dern had opened his eyes for 2 seconds to see the bucket that's sitting right there full of paint that's red, he might have picked up on the gag.
Well, they establish he's not bright.
Yeah.
And I love that, because there's this moment here where he's clearly not the sharpest tool in the shed, but then he calls his dad dumb.
Yep.
That was funny to me. And I genuinely, this was one of my favorite Bruce Dern performances, and I love Bruce Dern, but this.
Me too.
He was just so enjoyable, even though he's supposed to be sort of this mean criminal type person or outlaw type person. He was likable. Like, he kind of like,
yes.
I kind of like this guy.
He was evil, but there's like this endearing part of him where he's like, oh, honey.
Yeah.
You're just like, oh, sweetie, life is hard for you.
And I really, really enjoyed how he's like, yeah, I helped put the bars in because I didn't have anything else to do. Right? They're in real good.
Yeah. They tried to pull the bars out, and he's telling his dad, and it's attached to their saddles, and they're going to rip the bars out. And dad, he's trying to tell him it's not going to work. And then the saddles get pulled right off the horses with the riders on top of them. They're all sitting on the ground. I tried to tell you it wasn't going to work. Well, how do you know? Because I helped lay the bars.
I love it. He's like, well, I had nothing else to do, and they were going to do it anyway, whether I helped them or not.
So I love how they set that gag up. No bars. And I'm like, this is a joke that kind of continuously builds as the movie progresses. And I really love that sense of humor. And that's actually pretty clever for a movie that was shot fairly quickly to just keep people working. It was something the union was like, okay, we want everybody to keep working. So they just kind of came up with something really quick to shoot. And the only person who made more than scale was James Gardner.
Wow.
So to have that kind of clever writing happen in such quick fashion. Yeah, I think that was pretty good.
Well, and I love how all the humor is very, like, it's not like slapsticky. It walks right up to that line and then stops, right? Even them getting both the saddles, but then that's the closest to slapstick as it gets.
Yeah.
That in the cannon scene.
Yes.
The rest of it's very late 60s, early 70s, sort of that goofy crowd humor, like with the fighting and the mud fight at the beginning of the movie. Right? That's all feels very 60s to me, but not slapsticky, if that makes sense at all.
Yeah, I kind of get what you're saying. Like, it's sort of dark and dirty, but it's not, doesn't go beyond that line that you have where it's just absurd.
Yes, exactly. It walks up right up to that, the point of being absurd and then stops.
Yes. It's not absurd comedy. And like a lot of it is actually kind of incredibly clever because like when we say that the Dambies aren't as good as everybody thinks they are, they aren't as tough and rough as everybody thinks they are. It's kind of funny to find that out.
Yeah, there's this legend built up. And when Pa originally confronts Jason to get his son out of jail, he comes in, gun pointing right at him, and he just sticks his finger in the gun. It's like, how dare you? And then he becomes more genial and realizes, oh, maybe the sheriff was actually in the right in arresting my son. And I'm going to have to let him sweat in there for a little bit to get him out because the sheriff's not going to give him up easily.
And well, there was this weird undercurrent where they talk about how Pa used to like shoot first, ask questions later. Like he used to be too hot-headed. And it was this kind of running joke where they're like, oh, well, so you need to slow down. Just think things through, Pa. Like that was kind of a weird note, but I loved it.
Well, yeah. And I think part of it, too, is the fact that he realized that the sheriff wasn't going to be intimidated and he wasn't afraid. And he might actually be confident, unlike the previous three sheriffs.
Mm-hmm.
Because Jason is the fourth sheriff in a very short period of time.
Oh,
two got dead and one got run out of town.
And the joke is they're like, well, how much does it pay? And they keep talking about the other sheriffs. They're like, well, they didn't stay long enough to find out how much they get paid.
Yeah, nobody survived long enough or stuck around long enough to get their first paycheck.
Yep.
Now, we got to at least give some kudos to Jack Ellum here as the kind of forced, forced to be a deputy very slyly by Jason, James Gardner, who needs deputy, and really anybody would have done. And yeah, he finds Jack Ellum, who's completely resistant doing it. This guy literally works in the stable shoveling horse shit and is kind of the town fool. And during a big fight within the saloon, he has Jason's back, just like, hey, didn't want the wrong thing happening here. They had the draw on Jason.
Yeah.
Who wound up taking care of most of it, but he gets one of the guys and Jason feels appreciative. It's like, well, you know, now you've supported me, so you've got a target on your back, so you might as well be my deputy now.
Yeah.
And I like the fact that Jason's really supportive of him and even says, like, you're a faster draw than the Danbys, right?
Yeah.
He says, I've seen you draw and I've seen Bruce Dern's Danby draw and you're faster, right? So it's like, now you just need to learn control.
Yeah, he says he's a terrible shot, but if he'd been 5 feet further away, he would have missed his target entirely.
Yeah.
And he's like, no, it just takes practice. I work with you for a few days and you'll be fine.
Yeah. And that's where the whole shooting the nail into the pole scene plays out. And I love how that sort of scene sort of ends where it's like, well, you keep practicing and I'm going to go get Danby and then go.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, well,
and he's not even looking, right?
Yeah, exactly. He's so aware of his surroundings and just going, of course he's going to try to. We're practicing out here. He sees we're distracted. Of course he's going to leave.
Yeah.
No, it was pretty good.
So funny. Just having like the jail with no bars is just, it's gold. It's absolute gold when it comes to like comedic scenarios you could come up with.
And they made great use of those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some of the stuff I didn't find, like the clumsy daughter of Prudy, those things I didn't care for that much, but I'm not big on pratfall humor and stuff. And poor girl, she's like, gets in a fight in the streets, rolling around in mud. She's hiding in a tree in her underwear after she's trying to get cleaned because, hey, Jason's getting room and board, and guess where he's staying? Mayor's house. So she's like, oh, here's this handsome guy who's coming into my house, and here I am muddied up in my underwear, and he knows why. So she's very embarrassed by that. And then she gets caught in the tree, still embarrassed. And then when her bustle catches on fire. Yeah.
Yeah, which I found very terrifying because, I mean, that was the whole thing. Like, with a lot of layers of fabric that were surrounding women throughout history, women have died because of that.
Yeah.
Catch them on a candle, they've died.
Yeah. Well, and I want to point out an elephant in the room. She is the richest person in town, and she's still making dinner for these men.
Well, it's one of those sexism things is the whole point. Like,
but
she doesn't have, she's
hired
the
somebody.
Richest. Yeah, I know, but she's the richest woman in town, and Dad has decided that that's what's going to happen. But it also could be because she doesn't.
There's no way to hire?
Yeah.
Well, and also, I think
it's a very male town.
Well, I mean, let's take the sexism out of for a second, she might have just been wanting to impress Jason.
I think part of it was that.
And you're actually, I think you hit the nail on the head there, going back to nails. But yeah, I think that she wanted to make an impression on him. You're right. Now that I think about it, because I think about the scene where she's making the dinner and she's putting a lot of attention and care into it. And that's why she gets distracted and gets herself set on fire.
Yeah.
Yeah. But she's humming. Dress up. Yeah. She's dressed up and she's humming and she's really happy through most of it and a little careless because she's got flour over her face. And of course, when she comes out and of course, on fire.
Yeah.
And I love how she like shaking her fist at Jason. Well, somebody better do something about this. I'm tired of this shit happening to me. I'm like, well okay. don't blame the sheriff, all right?
Well, it was weird because I had a very strong feeling that part of the character, and I think this is what maybe the actress had decided, is when you first see Prudy, she's dressed in like kind of overalls and pants and walking around town. And later on, when they take that little ride, she's wearing kind of, it looks like a skirt, but it's two-legged pants. She's not comfortable in that fancy dress wear. Like, the fashionable wear is not something she's really acclimatized to.
Yeah. No, and
she works her own mind. You can tell.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And
That was one of the things I thought we could sort of address in our remake, is sort of show that more, that she doesn't normally do the housekeeping or the homemaking, that they do have somebody doing it, but because of Jason, that's why she's in the kitchen and she's not good at it because she never does it. Sort of establish that dichotomy and that sort of personality of her as well, because it's kind of clumsily. That's probably the most clumsy part of the whole film, is how they handle Prudy.
Mm-hmm. And how they could have it where it's like, damn, Buzzle, like going, why do I have to get set on fire? I could wear something that just means I know when I'm set on fire.
Yeah.
It's unfair, but I hate it.
Wait, all those layers probably protected her in the long run.
But they wouldn't have caught, she wouldn't have needed the layer, like she caught on fire because of the layers. They also protected her, but they're also the problem.
Yeah, because they make her ass stick out an extra foot and a half.
Right?
Yeah, I don't know what it was about the old days and Bustles and stuff. I'm like, why would you want to make a lady's ass look fucking huge? Don't get it.
I don't know. There was Bustles and there was corsets and there was all sorts of garbage shit that's happened throughout the years. It's still happening. There's still garbage that is considered fashionable that it's supposed to be.
Yeah, I agree. Right. Well, as most of these Westerns, of somebody comes in to save the town, it's a very tropey thing in Westerns, results in a big gunfight, the OK Corral scene. Yes, the end scene is very much stripped out of High Noon. In fact, they, much like High Noon, where the town votes to stay out of it, happens more succinctly here. They're like, oh no. Yeah. There isn't a lot of argument. They're like, no, we're going to stay out of it. And Jace is very well aware of that this is probably going to happen. And his best course of action is to get the fuck out of Dodge, which results in one of the most insanely funny backwards scenes of realizing like he's being a coward. It's funny because Prudy's there's a relationship kind of developing there by this point, and Prudy's like, well, what are you gonna do? Oh, I think my best course of action is keep on going to Australia. And she goes, well, that's very mature, which results in him realizing from his point of view, he reasserts it, going, well, wait, he talks himself out of it because he's making a mature decision and he talks himself out of it because he thinks he sounds like a coward. And you would think that whole conversation would happen in the other direction.
Yes. And
I loved it.
And this also, to me, really underlies what makes Prudy crazy, because here's the deal. When you're having a conversation with the dude and you say something, and he's like, oh my God, you're right, and goes in the opposite direction because they don't fucking listen. It drives you crazy. And that's why she was driven crazy. I mean, honestly, having those interactions will drive a woman fucking up the wall.
Right? Let's do the, oh, she's agreeing with me. I got to do the opposite.
Right?
Can't have that.
That will drive a human being's mind crazy.
Well, does it really? I mean, obviously it does, but clearly she was trying sort of that reverse psychology thing on him and it worked. So, I mean, she even had that little look of amusement on her face as she watched him talk himself out of it. It's like she was planned all along.
it was sort of the thing where she said something to see what would happen and knowing absolutely that somebody's going to do the opposite. It will drive you crazy.
The look on her face going, what just happened afterwards? I'm not sure if that was completely her plan, but it does work out because it makes him stick around.
Yes.
Absolutely. But then we get to like where everybody comes to town. You get to the gunfight. And I kind of love the fact where she's shooting and he comes through the gunfight to kind of yell at her being like, you don't have to kill anybody. And she's like, he gave me a gun. What do you expect?
Yeah, exactly. Yep. They're shooting at me. I'm going to shoot them. Yeah.
Yeah. She's right. I only know one way to shoot and that's to kill.
Prudy is very prudent.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Once you kill him, they stop shooting. It's very realistic.
Yeah.
Or as Jason shows, you can just go, whoa, cross the street.
That was so funny.
Cross the street and going, okay, go ahead. So
I want to
there's
keep
more
time
one
out.
Way to, yeah, exactly. I didn't know you could time out gunfights, but apparently you can.
Yeah. Time out. Car.
And that's another joke that he builds up to because he does pull similar tricks throughout the movie and then it builds into this big thing. I'm like, that's fantastic. People do listen to him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even people who are shooting at him.
Okay. Let's get into some remake territory here. I think our first problem is our setting. Westerns don't sell, guys. Hate to say it. People don't make Westerns anymore. So how do we make this marketable? I mean, is it? I honestly think the Gold Rush idea isn't super important. You just need something in a town that's happening that needs that authority figure, that the guy to come in with the confidence to change it and make it better. That's the trope. That's the structure. And you don't always need, like, you don't need gold. You might need a MacGuffin, but it doesn't have to be that per se.
Well, we've seen it done in a couple of different ways in the past. We've seen the Bruce Willis remaking Fistful of Dollars in that sort of 1940s prohibition setting or 1920s prohibition setting. So that's always an option. And then there's also the science fiction option that we saw with High Noon where they made it as Outland. And so
And I was thinking of that too.
Well, I'm going to make it tougher on you guys because I'm going to take science fiction off the table because Sam and I already did that with the Trinity movies. So I don't want to do the same thing. I'm going to challenge us to do something different. I have two thoughts and I have two different ideas. And depending on which one you go with, that could really screw up my casting or it works. Okay. Now, idea number one was setting it in a kind of a 1960s small town where, and it could even be the same town as, yes, the Gold Rush is what built this town. And now as it's kind of prospering, but still hasn't grown into like Las Vegas, but there's money to be made here. And maybe it's like the mob or mafia coming in and doing kind of a protection racket and is trying to force their way into making money off of this town because there's nobody there to stop them.
Sort of like a little casino, like a little gambling town in Nevada kind of thing that started as, I like that. I actually genuinely like that.
I like the desert setting. That was sort of where my brain kind of went.
Idea number two is more wild. Magnificent Seven was based on Seven Samurai. Doesn't necessarily mean we can't go the other way. Why don't we move that into a either a Chinese dynasty or feudal Japan setting? Because it still works. I mean, it's going to probably screw up your casting entirely. But I was thinking about it and I'm like, well, I mean, you lose the guns. But, you know, to have that same cocky attitude with a little bit of that Jackie Chan clumsiness going on, which results in bad guys still getting beaten up because he's doing all these fast moves and dodges and stuff. I mean, you could do as simple as somebody pulls a sword on you and you stick a cork on the end. I mean, there are simple jokes that can be referential, but different. So that was idea number two for me. I was trying to think out of the box. Yes. Yes.
Where he's like, this blind samurai, but like super skilled and very calm. It just takes care of crap.
Yeah. We kind of touch upon that when we talked about Blind Fury.
Yeah. The one thing I kind of would like to keep is, and they allude to it in the movie and then they don't do anything with it, where it's the reason they actually have to give the Dambies the money is because of geography. And I kind of want the town to be somewhat limited in where you can escape to which is part of why these people have such a stranglehold on it.
Well, that was part of my thinking, too, where you can keep it a smaller town that it's still fairly out of the way. You know, you're probably an hour from the nearest big city or even bigger towns, but it's prosperous because of what's around it and their industry there. But not a lot of people still live there. It hasn't grown too big, but at the same time, there's still quite a bit of industry happening because of this town. And that can draw people in.
It can be like most mining towns, like even that we had it like in the past here, like with like Frank Slide, like it wasn't a huge town, but I mean, you have a mine, you have the mountains and you only have so many escape routes. So it's not going to get giant and be like a huge city when it's in the middle of the mountains,
mm-hmm.
regardless of how prosperous it is.
Yeah. So anybody else have some setting ideas? Like I've thrown two out there for you.
Yeah. No, and I'll be honest with you. I was thinking Western and I kind of stuck in that sort of frame of mind. And I'm inclined to go with your samurai idea, even though it does royally screw my casting, because if we set it in Nevada, that kind of gives me that sort of Walking Tall feel.
I got stuck on there too, because yeah, it felt mm-hmm. Walking Tallish when I was trying to do stuff. But I had it where it was like, it was in a desert setting, but it was sort of a very enclosed, like it's the Fort McMurray thing where it's like one way out, one way in. It's very hard to get in and out.
What if this is an outpost along the Silk Road.
Ooh.
One way in, one way out.
Nice.
So it could work. And then you could have mixed race casting as well, because you have sort of a meeting point where you have two cultures meeting.
Yes.
And spice trade is a great MacGuffin.
Oh, yeah. And you could have the whole thing. And the whole interesting where he's like, Jason wanted to go to Australia because he's so interested in this movie. Like he just wants to travel because he's like, I just want to see the world.
Yeah.
I mean, you keep that character.
The sort of the Marco Polo-esque type character, yeah.
Yeah, if you're going back that much further, that it can be more about exploration. There's, you know, I've heard whispers of this magical continent or whatever. He's the world traveler because nowadays really is about discovery. It's not reading about somebody else's discovery. He wants to discover it himself.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm starting to love this idea even more. Yeah, I like that idea a lot, actually, the idea of it being sort of multicultural, actually conflict of culture to a certain extent.
And the whole thing, because like with the Silk Road, like it's commerce and people want it to like freely go back and forth, but you're going to have problems. It's just the way it is.
Yeah.
Some people are going to think they're going to get ripped off. So you might look to try and make it a little bit more, it's less lawless, not completely lawful, but less lawless is what they're aiming for.
I mean, you can have a Ronin coming through town or samurai or whatever. In this case, could have been a foreign traveler. That suppresses this lawlessness. We've got our MacGuffin with the Silk Road. I think that works. I like Prudy still being a bit accident prone, attractive to suitors, because the mayor does seem to be subtly going, hey, you're not interested, right? Because like when he thinks about everybody in this town, you should be interested. She's the best. You're the best catch for her kind of thing.
Yeah.
So the whole marrying off your daughter scenario, and we can have maybe her resisting that because, you know, it'd still be that situation of her dowry goes to the male. In some cases, well, that part of the world still does. So
yeah, like any wealth she has, not just her dowry, basically anything she possibly possesses no longer belongs to her.
Yeah. And I like the idea that she has some power, and part of our story is resistant to giving it up in any way, shape, or form. Yeah. And that could be part of the character going, well, no, you can keep everything. I just want to share it with you. You know, I want to share your life with you, and I'll help you do this thing. And that's elevates that character as well, because that is something that Jason, I think, was thinking about marrying her mainly for her money. It does feel like that's sitting in the back of his mind and is a little sketchy, and it kind of reduces that character. Especially when the ore house gets blown up and we find out he was a frequent customer.
Yeah.
And I like that it's called the ore house because it was, it's a wordplay, but it was named after a producer off of Maverick that James Gardner had a beef with.
Madame Ore's house.
Yeah.
But at the end though, he does say is like, no matter how many kids we have, we're going to pack up and go to Australia. So, I mean, like, he was really thinking at the end.
Mm-hmm. No, he still wants to live the life the way he wanted it. He just wanted somebody to share it with at that point. And I think that's cool. But you know, that conflict in his brain wasn't very well explored, I think. And that's something that could be added here. And it would also strengthen Prudy's character instead of being just a comical foil. We could have
love interest.
Yeah. And love interest. We can have a little bit of conflict going, well, you know, you just want my money kind of thing. And we can see that struggle a little bit more. It's a subtle thing, but it adds a little more character, right?
But I'd also like her to want to like have some sort of adventure. She's like, yeah, I have money and I have power here, but I'm still kind of treated like a second class citizen. I wouldn't mind looking and see what else is out there.
Mm-hmm. Where like I see her as being, you ever watch those old Chinese Jackie Chan movies where he's not actually a very good martial artist. He just happens to be very good at it by being clumsy. That's her.
Yes.
Like that drunken fist style. whereas your main character, Jason, he's the confident one. You know, he's going to be good at whatever we have him do, depending on the type of character he's going to be, whether he's Chinese, Japanese, or a foreigner that's come into town, which could be interesting. It would be Chinese would be having swords and things and he would have a gun because they didn't carry guns. So that would be also interesting if it was a foreigner.
I have another idea where, you know how he says, well, Jake's probably like the second fastest gun in town. What I would love to do is be like, Jake's, oh, you're about the third best. And he thinks Prudy's probably second best. He's like, if I just work with her, I could make her really good.
Yeah, I don't know. How clumsy are, would you want to give her a gun
or a sword
or really anything that is lethal?
Here's the thing. I don't think she's clumsy because when she shoots to kill, she shoots to kill. She doesn't miss. She's very good. I just think she's just how she goes about things is wrong. Like she's not actually clumsy. Yeah, she doesn't have grace. She comes in like a sledgehammer is really basically her failing, not the fact that she's clumsy.
Well,
she's skilled.
I mean, and these people are. And these people were homesteaders before they found the mine, right? So everybody's going to know how to shoot at some level, right?
But she's not like she takes out those two guys with two shots. She is not bad. But that doesn't mean like there's some of those guys are terrible shots. Like how many shots do they let go and they don't hit anybody?
Well, I think that's sort of and I was kind of thinking the same way is it's not that she's clumsy so much as she's a tomboy. She grew up in an outpost where she had to learn how to do the things that men would do, but she's still being treated like a woman. And that's where that sort of juxtaposition comes or the conflict comes is she's expected to behave like a woman and act like a woman and do things like a woman, but her skill set is all these skills like shooting and fighting and mining or whatever we end up, well, it wouldn't be mining in this case, but it's all those things that she needs to do to maintain her.
Yeah. So her she business. Has to come in harder to get more respect. Like she's got that chip on her shoulder because she has to come in hard for people to give her any respect at all.
Yeah, she's learning to do the things that are traditionally male roles, and she's certainly resistant to the female role, and she doesn't know how to be a traditional lady, quote unquote, and she's not comfortable being that.
She has no desire.
And I like even setting that even more in a dynasty or, you know, like our Silk Road idea. Being even more resistant to that kind of role and very self-sufficient, which is often in conflict with her father's desires.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of the town, for that matter.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, because she was kind of infamous in town.
Yes.
But I like the idea that, like, she is infamous in town. They don't want to treat her like a man, but they still don't dare get on her bad side.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the great thing about just changing the setting, most of this still works. You're replacing guns with swords and the jokes adapt a little bit. But if you throw in a little of that Jackie Chan aesthetic, it's all going to work just fine. Like the Jack Alum character isn't changing too much.
No.
You know, being elevated from a lower status into one of respect still works here. The mayor of the town doesn't really change in that regard. And maybe some of the verbiage does, but that's about it. It all kind of still works. And that's why like samurai movies worked so well as Westerns is the main story still kind of worked regardless of you're wearing a duster or a gi.
Yeah. Cause it was about that conflict and it's like about, you know, lawlessness and order. And that's what both movies were looking at.
Also solves our pro police problem by making it a foreign film where there's a little less of that conversation going on.
Well, and it's not.
And it makes it, and continues being a period piece as well. So, and it also is a way of showing, like, you know, you don't have to distrust every policeman. There are good ones just as well as bad ones.
Well, and it's about somebody's like, I'm just keeping the peace. It's not like it's a peace officer, not so much a police officer.
Yeah, he never abuses his position.
It's the rarity of it all. And it honestly, it does point to the whole point with the kind of semi-corrupt council, where they're like, we kind of want everything to stay the same, but a little bit different, because we still like making our money and we won't put too much effort in to making the town the way it probably should be if it's got law in it. Well, like when he talks to James Garner, he's like, please don't do this. And James Garner's like, do you want me to be sheriff or not? Because if I'm going to be the sheriff, I'm going to do the damn job.
Yeah, because all he even says, I'll kind of miss the rough and tumbleness of it all. And I mean, he explains it, and there's this nostalgia about it. And you kind of understand where he's coming from.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of fun to a point. And I think that's what he's trying to convey, is like, we want some of the adventureness and some of the wild westness of this town to stick around, but we just need to get rid of like the really bad stuff.
Yeah.
And
And part of the town, it's like a fear of change. Like, okay, it's working under this structure. It's not ideal, but if we resist again, it could be worse. And they're afraid of the could be worse, not considering that it could be better too.
Right. Well, and then, like they say, when they want the lawlessness, but not all of the lawlessness, they're trying to have their cake and eat it too. Yeah. You want to get rid of the stuff that just you don't like, but you don't even consider that it's not good for other people. There's other stuff that isn't working.
Yeah, I mean, it's still kind of frontier justice. You're probably not going to get hung if, you know, somebody's thieving and you fight back and you win. But, you know, you're killing somebody in cold blood. Yeah, you're going to go sit in that barless jail cell.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got
to
keep
that. Do they ever get a judge?
Yeah, you know what? They did address that they're looking for one, but it never actually, we never get that far as the appointment. I feel like that was a part of the story that kind of went nowhere, and maybe we can add back in, but because I kept thinking as I was watching the movie, it's like, oh, who's going to be the judge? Who's going to be brave enough to rule against them? Like, that should have been something too. Well, there's no judge, and what judge would vote against my son and not fear the wrath of our family?
Yeah.
So that, I mean, that was a way out too. He could just let his son rot in there until the sentencing, and he'd probably be sent scot-free.
Yeah. And I loved how Joe never thought it would ever happen. He's like, oh, they're not going to hang me. Like, he's just loosey-goosey about it.
Yeah, there's that naivete about him. I was just thinking that you could actually have a little bit of fun with that, because you could actually have some conflict. I think we've kind of semi-established that this is kind of a meeting point of two cultures. So you could have sort of that conflict of, well, you could have like a Chinese magistrate who wants to try the Joe character, but you could also have an Italian or English or whatever you want him to be magistrate trying to say, well, no, this is a crime against a Caucasian person, so I need to judge it. So you could kind of have that sort of that kind of conflict happening.
And you could also introduce with the British ones, like, you guys don't know what you're doing. That's that foppish kind of white guy thinks he knows how to run everything type of deal. And that's not the way it is.
Yeah, exactly.
I like it. Now, I can see we're going to have some merging of cast to make this work.
Yeah.
Because I was really married to the doing the foreign film idea, so I have a completely Chinese cast. But now that we have a mixed cast, that's great, because we can use some of yours, some of mine, and somewhere in between, we will have a very well-rounded cast, hopefully.
Yes.
Yeah, it was kind of nice. I like the idea that we've mixed all the kind of elements of this idea in a historic setting, and yeah, it all kind of still works. Like, the one thing I was resistant to was bringing it into any kind of modern setting, because I felt like it wasn't going to work in a modern setting.
In the modern setting, there's very few places that are kind of cut off like they have to be for this to work.
Yeah, like the most modern I wanted to make it was around the 1960s, where Jason could have been a veteran of war, which is where he would have picked up some of his skills and maybe why he's resistant to shooting anybody, which still could work in the setting we've got it in. There are certainly plenty of conflicts, but that was kind of as far as I wanted to take it, because yes, I think past that point, and as the world modernizes, there's less and less cut off, and there's less chance of any crooked people getting away with this sort of thing. So to keeping the 1960s, I think, was as far as we could have taken it. But
yeah,
we went the other direction, which I kind of dig.
Yeah, I think this works a lot better because to have it, there's very few places where even if you're starting a town, most places will have some sort of law enforcement. And even if it's just a tiny settlement, the next town will take care of it. That's the whole point. Like, even if you don't have police in your town, nowadays, the next town will just put you in their area.
Exactly. Yeah. You have a region that's taken care of by whatever your law enforcement ends up being or turns out to be. And a lot of the things that happen in this movie, just the repercussions of these things would be very different.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. The big high noon thing at the end.
Exactly. Or even the murder that sort of sets everything rolling. I mean, in a modern setting, there, you're not going to have this half-assed jail cell and no judge and no legal process for this man.
Yeah.
And I think if we go back in time, you could have that ambiguity of, well, yeah, we don't really have anything in place yet because we're so new and we've never needed it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, before we go on, just one thing I wanted to note, which I really kind of loved about the movie, is when they have Joe in front of that cannon and his dad is, oh, well, he gets to make the decision. Like, I don't know, I can make this cannon go or you can drop your guns. And it was a nice note, whereas, yeah, he is a father at the end of the day. He loves his son. So he'll put down his gun.
Yeah, well, the whole point of the conflict was to rescue Joe and get him out of jail.
Yeah.
Which would have been a death sentence for his son because he committed cold-blooded murder. That would have been a hanging, most likely.
But he'll go to jail to save his son's life. Like, that's kind of, to me, a big moment for Pa Dameron.
Yeah. The one thing I kind of like about the characters is there is respect. Like, Pa learns respect for Jason pretty quickly. And so does Joe. You know, he's pretty mouthy when he gets dragged into jail and he's going to walk away at the earliest opportunity. And by the end, he's kind of sitting there willingly to the point where he's even helping lay in the bars. So,
I think
he gets used to it.
I think he kind of admires Jason, actually. I think that he almost wants to be his friend.
Yeah, probably until he got, you know, strapped to the cannon, which Jason thinks is unloaded. Yeah. It's not. And that's what blows up the Madame Orr's whorehouse.
And then when it blows it up, you can see Joe just faints dead away. It's a very short moment, but it's hilarious.
Yeah. And after this big explosion happens there, and the women rush out, and the mayor comes out, and all of the other founders of this town are coming out of the whorehouse. It's like, oh boy.
Yeah.
You're all scumbags.
Right?
But they're not. In that time, that was perfectly acceptable. Especially.
No. Oh, that's not what I meant. When I'm saying, like, they're not scumbags for being in the whorehouse. They're scumbags for being cowards and just going to the whorehouse rather than helping Jason.
I totally support. You're absolutely right. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. They voted to not help, and that's where they were going to hang their hat while everything was going on.
Yeah. While a guy was going to die, they were just going to do that.
Yep. Scumbags. Okay, well, let's get to some casting here. Sam, why don't you start us off? We already know mine's an all-Chinese casting, so I'll use mine to round out yours.
Okay, so I was thinking we were staying in a Western. I started with my Jason, and I actually had my Jason before I even watched the movie, ironically, because I thought he'd be great as a sort of stand-in for James Garner. I went with Josh Brolin.
Nice.
For my Prudy, I went with Jordana Brewster from the Fast and Furious movies. I think that she's got that really interesting facial structure and she's a good actress. I think that she'd do that really well. And she could sort of elevate it and bring a little bit of that action skill that she does have from the Fast and the Furious movies into that character.
And I don't know, there's something about her facial structure that I think it feels like classic Old West. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. For my Ollie Perkins, I went a little bit older than maybe I really wanted to, but I went with Dustin Hoffman. I think he'd be great in that role.
Yes. I love that. That's good.
For my Joe Danby, I went with Jensen Ackles.
Ha ha! Free Jensen Ackles.
He's free. Yes, he's been freed. He's good.
He's good.
I know.
The movement is over.
Yeah. And I think he could play that hapless character really well. I think he'd have a lot of fun doing it too.
I love that.
And then sorry for the little bit of stunt casting here. I cast as his father, Pa Danby. I cast Jeffrey Morgan, even though he did play his dad in Supernatural. But I thought Jeffrey Morgan would be really great and would play that toughness a little bit really well for Pa Danby.
Yeah. Jeffrey Morgan was made for Westerns. I don't know what the deal is. Like, yeah. If he's in any other genre, I'm like, I don't get it. But you put him in a Western, I'm like, oh, there we go.
Exactly. And then for my Jake, I did do a little bit of gender bending here because I thought it would be kind of fun to have another strong female character in the movie. Nice. So I cast Natasha Lyonne as Jake.
Oh, if we could combine her with the town drunk, that would be amazing.
Yes. And I was kind of playing along that up with sort of like the, where she's, it just adds a little bit more to that character.
Yeah.
And then for like my director,
Gene Wilder in Blazing Saddles.
Yeah. And then for my director, because he's done action comedy so well in so many other genres, I went with Matthew Vaughn. I think he does a really good job of balancing action and comedy.
Good cast. Trish, I'm guessing you cast for a Western as well. So have at her.
I did. But I did something different because when I mentioned Blazing Saddles, and I had two options for Jason because I thought it would be fun because they're both two people I feel who could pull off that I'm just calmly doing my job and I'm just doing what I'm doing. So my first option was like Idris Elba because he's tall and tough. I was going to play into the trope where it's like, well, I mean, do we want a black sheriff? I'm like, well, beggars can't be choosers. We need a sheriff. And he would totally like just elevate it. Then I put John Cho. Again, another thing is like, do you need a Korean sheriff? Again, beggars can't be choosers. So it would be a very interesting way to kind of put that into that genre. Because, I mean, they do need a sheriff and nobody else is going to take the job. So that's where I landed with Jason. It's one of those two. And then for Prudy, I went with Jenny Slate, very talented comedian. And she can do a little bit unhinged if she really, really wants to. And I think she would just be a very delightful energy to Prudy because she could also bring that I'm so pissed off because like, yeah, I know I'm just a girl, but damn it, I should have more to do here. And then I did some gender bending, but to a different character. I made it Ma Danby and I made it Melissa McCarthy because nice. I think she could pull that off.
Good. I like that.
Like just tough. For Ollie Perkins, I went with James Spader. I would like to introduce his weirdness into that area.
Well, considering he likes weird sex and stuff, yeah, he'll be at Matamoros.
He would be. Yeah, exactly. He's like, yeah, he would be spending a lot of time at Matamoros and there'd be talk. You could just add a little subtext there.
Yeah.
For Jake, I went with Ólafur Darri Ólafsson. He's an Icelandic actor. He's been in quite a few things. He was in The Meg. He was that kind of big guy. And he was also in Lady Dynamite with Maria Bamford. He's a very good comedic actor, but I think he could, like what Jack Ellum brought to this character was just like a certain endearingness. Like I was so charmed by him. He was a bit put upon, but I mean, he owned it. He was very happy. And then at the very end where he's like, he says, and then I was known as the greatest sheriff of all time. I love that moment. It was beautiful. And I believe this guy can do it.
Yeah. I love the look on his face when he says that line. It's like, yeah, you believe me, don't you?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, I right after that line, I made a note going, unreliable narrator.
Right? Exactly. And then for the Danbys, Joe Danby, who spends most of his time in a jail cell, I went with Sebastian Stan because he can do comedy and I don't think he gets enough of an opportunity. And then Tom Danby, I went with Daniel Brühl, who's like his enemy in Falcon and the Winter Soldier, but they're going to be brothers in this one. And then Luke Danby was Jack Quaid from The Boys. I feel like they look sort of similar to be brothers. It's kind of, I started the casting and then afterwards I looked at them and they're like, yeah, they could be related. It's very odd. I managed to stumble upon that.
I didn't get to that far into the casting with the brothers because they were kind of barely present in the movie. So I'm like, they're not as important, but yeah, they should be there. So good casting.
I was going to add them a little bit more in my idea of the movie where they would try to help. They would come up with stupid schemes to try and help Pa or Ma in this case.
Yeah.
Be like, well, we could do this, Ma. It would just be like some dumbassery, but it would be fun to watch them try to.
Some Wile E. Coyote stuff. Yeah. Yes.
Oh, yeah. You got to have gags, man. You got to have gags.
The only thing missing would be you could probably maybe add it. It's like they order stuff from Acme, like just stuff like that would be good. And then I only cast one of the other councilmen, Henry Jackson, because I feel he's the only one that kind of has a lot of lines. And I put Dean Norris as that because I feel Dean Norris is very westerny and it would be funny to see him play a weaselly kind of guy. But that's what I went with. I didn't have a director, but I like the idea of Matthew Vaughn. But yeah, so I don't have a very Asian cast, but I'm sure, like, well, I've got John Cho, but again, it's multicultural, so we'll have a lot of options here.
Yeah, whereas I was initially thinking this was going to be, in my mind, fully foreign version of this film. So when we start mixing and matching our casts, I think we'll come up with the right mixture here. But my mind is fully Chinese. For my director and my star, as my version of Jason, I went with Stephen Chow because, yeah, you know, you get the Kung Fu Hustle guy. I could totally see this working. And so he would be my lead as well as my director. For Prudy, I went with Bing Bing Fan, who was Blink in X-Men Days of Futures Past for our American audiences. Wait. For Pa Danby, I went with Sammo Hung.
Yes.
Yeah.
He's fantastic. And for people who don't know, he was in his career stretches way back to like Game of Death with Bruce Lee. And My Lucky Stars was another big Chinese comedy. For my Ollie Perkins, well, if Sammo Hung's in here, you got to reconnect him with Jackie Chan. So I went with him as my Ollie Perkins, the mayor of this town. So as somebody who's approaching his 70s, I don't want him doing a lot of stuff anymore, but he's sure fun to watch still, and I would love to have him ever present in this.
He's talented at comedy.
He did. So. He is. Exactly. I'd like to see him stick to those comic roots, and he's good at it. For Joe Danby, I went with Daniel Wu. And for Jake, I went with Benedict Wong.
Yes. Thank you. I was about to say Benedict Wong has to be in here somewhere. He's really great.
Of course, I thought about it. He was the first one that came to mind. So with Daniel Wu, he was in Rogue One. So we have a couple of American Chinese actors in here, along with some Chinese mainstays as well. But this is kind of my all-star cast of a Chinese version of this movie. But yeah, I think we got a good cast, especially if we mix and match with these. And we'll have our Silk Road movie for sure. I'm not sure if we can still call it Support Your Local Sheriff, but might need a slight title change. But, I mean, the plot still applies.
Yeah, it would be. What could it be?
I mean, even now, Support Your Local Sheriff, it was always meant to be a riff off of these old bumper stickers they used in the 60s to support your local police department. So since we don't see those kind of things anymore, the even the title being a spoof of something, nobody gets the joke anymore, right? Especially now, actually, it has a whole different connotation now.
Yeah.
Well, that was the whole thing. Like, was it Walking Tall where we had the guy, you're voted in as sheriff.
Yeah.
You're not given the job because you're capable. You're just voted in. It's a political station.
Yeah, that was Walking Tall.
Mm-hmm.
And a myriad of other movies.
If it's political. Yeah. But to me, like, okay, sheriff, you shouldn't have to campaign to be sheriff. It shouldn't be a political thing. You should be able to do the job or you can't. That's it.
Yeah, it should be based on merit and skill rather than how well you can talk.
Well, yeah. And I mean, like, if you're a politician, I mean, you're just asking for backdoor deals. That's all you're asking for if you make them a politician.
Old West and setting in our period piece kind of solves that because you want the best man for the job. It's not you're not having to deal with a whole lot of press at that point. It is do the job, do it well. That was it.
Yep.
You know, not a lot of politics being involved in the cases. Now it's like you got to talk to the press and keep things, some secrets to yourself and others. And then, of course, you got the pressures on from on high. It's a whole thing. I mean, you are working for the town. You're an employee. That's how it works in this movie.
Yeah. The whole point of having law enforcement is it should be. Nobody is above the law here. I'm the sheriff and you might be somebody, some big hoity-toity, but unfortunately, if you did something wrong, you did something wrong. It's not my job to be cowtown anybody.
Ha, cowtown, Western, ha.
Exactly. Cowtown anybody.
Well, you know, this is a fun one. I certainly enjoyed Kit Reader's suggestion this week. And if you would like to make a fan challenge, you can do that at Invasion Remake on Twitter, Invasion of the Remake on Facebook and Instagram, and invasionoftheremake@gmail.com. Now, if you want to make a fan challenge, few criteria. One, nothing after the year 2000. Two, don't tell me to remake Citizen Kane. Not going to happen. If it's already a stellar movie, we can only make it worse, which is sometimes fun.
Yep.
But chances are we're going to say no. I have to tell them in advance, like, hey, Sam, we want to make us a, we can't remake this as a good movie. Yeah. We got to remake it as a bad one.
To be fair, we have the most skill and the most experience seeing how to make things worse.
Oh, God, yes.
No question.
No question at all. And please tell us where to find it. Help source it for us. It makes it a little easier for us to track it down. If you know it's sitting over on Netflix, great. Mm. If it's over on Amazon or pay-per-view somewhere, you know, let us know. If you saw it for cheap sale, whatever, somewhere. Anywhere, just let us know how to source it. And if, especially if it's a harder to find movie, it'll certainly up your chances of us doing an episode of it. But if I think it's too good or it's happened too late, like, I don't want to shit on a recent movie that just feels easy and cheap to me. So, let's take an old one and see how we can improve it. You can also help out this show by making suggestions to your friends. Say, hey, this show's really fun. Check it out. And you can subscribe on all your favorite podcast providers, or you can visit our website. Sam, what's the website?
It is invasionoftheremake.wixsite.com/podcast.
And over there, you can find a handy little button that says store. And on that store, there's lots of cool designs by the Invader cast and crew and cool stuff like posters with our episode titles of what we did. We've got some of our more meme-worthy catchphrases on there. We've got the podcaster masks. We've got the angry fish line and so much more. You can get them as posters and t-shirts and mugs and hoodies and PPE masks and so much more. So go check it out. Every sale, every penny of those sales goes back into the production of the show. So by wearing something cool, you're also helping keeping the show on the air.
And the quality you get at TeePublic is pretty good too. Though, I mean, you get a nice bit of stuff. Like, it's very good.
It is. Yeah. The cotton t-shirts are really nice.
They are super comfy, aren't they?
They are. And they don't shrink.
No,
much.
Not much. No. I've always, when I've gotten them and wash them over and over and over again, they've barely shrunk. So then they're usually say fully soft and the print stays, like, I've had some now for a year or two and the image is still pretty crisp. So especially with the wear and tear I give them. So if they can do that, that's pretty good printing quality over there.
Absolutely.
So get one. So I think that's it for support your local sheriff. What'd you guys think about this one?
Oh, it was a fun watch. It was very much a fun watch. And I'm really glad that Kit recommended it because I had mentioned before we recorded that I was going to watch it on a streaming service and he mentioned it. I'm like, okay, well, I'll wait then. So, because I was really excited to watch this one.
You know, I thought it was so good. I was so charmed by everything. And like I say, the jail with no bars is the gift that keeps on giving. I keep thinking of like thousands of other gags they could have done. It was amazing.
Now, if anybody wants to go view this movie for themselves, go for it. There is actually not so much a sequel as a follow-up. A lot of the same actors return for a movie called Support Your Local Gunfighter. Much of the same actors, but in different roles. They're different characters in different roles, kind of like American Horror Story, where the same key people turn up in different parts. So it's another comedic Western, but different roles for the same actors from this one. So kind of a sequel, but more of just like a thematic follow-up.
Can you imagine American Horror Story, but as like a comedy and they just kept using the same people?
I'm kind of wondering why they haven't done it yet. I mean, we've got we've got American Crime Story, we got American Horror Story that does it, and some other stuff that's starting to pop up. But yeah, I don't know. The comedy world needs to kind of rejigger itself a little bit because I feel like that comedy is on a bit of a lull and a low right now. And it's just going to take a couple of interesting heads and minds to reinvigorate the genre. And we need that in Westerns as well. Westerns was one of the number one genres for a very long time and nobody makes them anymore. Yeah. There's a mystique about the Old West that is still endearing now, but it's very rare when somebody makes a good one. I'm glad to revisit these old ones.
The strange thing is the most kind of areas where any Western setting has been successful recently has been in horror.
It's true. And there's a couple really good horror Westerns out there.
Huh.
There's Bone Tomahawk. And then there's one, I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but it has Scott Eastwood in it.
Yeah. And there's another one with like the wind on the plains or something like that, where it's, yeah, it's strange that like kind of horror is sort of bringing Westerns back.
Well, it's happening somewhere, so I'm glad people are still paying attention to it. And yeah, maybe through the back door we'll get more of those. And I'm sure our Western fans are going, why haven't you covered True Grit? Well, I keep scheduling it and then it keeps getting bumped, but
yeah,
it'll happen someday. I do want to cover it, but it could be a little while. We've just done one, so we don't want to do it like horror because you're going to get tired of the Westerns like everybody else. So yeah, as much as we love it, and I could do a whole month of Westerns, I'm not going to subject our audience to it because we want to keep you. But next week, we're back to a comparison. I think we're going to do a horror next week. So all our horror fans have been patiently waiting. Like, hey, we haven't gotten a horror in a long time. You're getting one next week. So until then, I'm Jason.
I'm always Sam.
And I continue to be Trish.
And we are out of here.
Have you figured what you're going to do?
More or less.
What?
Well, I thought I might just leave town. Just get out of town before they ride in. Just ride out and keep on going.
I don't believe it.
Well, I don't know why not. I've never made any secret of the fact that basically I'm on my way to Australia, and I don't think I'm going to find a better time to get started than right now. Besides, I don't like the odds.
I just don't believe it.
Well, you better believe it, because it's not going to be too many hours before you look up, and I'll be long gone.
I think that that is one of the most mature things I've ever heard of a man doing.
But you think it's what?
Mature. Almost any other man would have to stick around to prove that they are a man and get a whole town shot up to boot.
Mature.
Mature as opposed to childish and shot full of holes.
You don't think it sounded a little cowardly? I mean, for a man to take a job and then when the going gets a little rough, he just sneaks out in the dead of night?
Well, of course, you didn't say whether you were going to do it in the day or the night.
But the point is, didn't it sound a little cowardly to you?
No, I told you it sounds mature.
Well, it sounded a little cowardly to me just now when I said it.
Well, it isn't. It's mature.
The reason I know it's cowardly is because I have never done a cowardly thing in my life, no matter what you or anybody else might think.
Well, I didn't say what
I thought. And it isn't mature. It is cowardly. Now, let's just call things by the right name from now on, huh?
What is the matter with you?
I'm just surprised at a girl that will keep throwing herself at a man when she secretly thinks he's a coward. Let's go back to town.
What do you mean, throwing myself at you?
Did you really think that I was going to turn tail and run at the first sight of trouble?
Well, why shouldn't I? That's what you just said you were
going to
do.
Well, I'm not going to, so you just forget about it.